Hello, I'm Ed Butler and welcome to In the Balance, the World Service programme that examines the biggest stories from the world of business and finance and looks at how they affect us all. So it is 2018, folks. Those of you who took a New Year break will no doubt, I imagine, be adjusting to life back at the desk, the coal face, the school run, wherever it is for you. And to mark the New Year, we are looking today at what this year might hold in terms of business, finance, and inevitably, a bit of geopolitics too. In a moment, my panel of distinguished guests. But first, some people on the street you might want to hear from. We asked some randomly chosen citizens of Nairobi, Madrid and Mumbai about their expectations for 2018. Job worries seemed high on their lists.
Right now we are lacking jobs because in 2017 we had an election. Most of the investors who are in Kenya have flee out outside the country since August, but up to date, most of them are not there.
I feel optimistic about the economy in 2018, although there are still some social problems to solve in Spain. Nowadays, even if you have a good education and some degree of experience, even then you're not able to get a good job.
I am pretty much worried about everything when it comes to finances because I end up spending everything, you know, living in a metropolitan city, housing, and then food, and then commutation. That actually leaves a dent on your pocket.
I'm expecting 2018 to be a far better one. The inflation has increased, but prices are so high, and the incomes are on the same level. So naturally, it is hard for us.
Two rather depressed-sounding Indians, a Spaniard and a Kenyan there. Well, with his own prognostications, our own citizen of the world now joins us, Colm O'Regan, on the line from Dublin. Happy New Year, Colm. Normally,
Happy
you
New
do
Year.
A diary for us, don't you, for a few minutes at this stage of the programme. You've done things slightly differently this time.
Yeah, I thought rather than launching into a big long screed of what I think is going to happen in 2018, I'd break it up into little chunks. It just makes it less obvious to the listener that I haven't a clue what I'm talking about, which is true. And also, I should say that anything I would say does have the suffix unless there's nuclear war.
Right. What have you got for us?
Well, I suppose seeing as it's a business programme, I should start with the markets. And I don't know a whole lot about markets. I know that MFID2 is coming in 2018. To me, MFID sounds like somebody swearing about their ID. But I watch the markets a little bit more now because last year was the first year that I got a pension for myself. And pensions, of course, depend a lot on luck, as in what year were you unlucky or lucky enough to be born in. So what happens at the moment isn't that relevant to me because I hope they'll have it all sorted out by the time I retire when I'm 80. But when I look at markets these days, maybe I'm imagining it, but the kind of mad stuff that happens in the political sphere doesn't seem to bother them as much. I always had this image of markets being like a skittish calf, that if anything spooked them, they would rush off and get stuck in the nearest hedge. But now it seems, since all of the political upheaval, markets are more philosophical, as if they're saying, well, you know, the world keeps on turning. Or is it because companies are so enormous now, no matter what happens in the world, they can't lose. They can play every side of the coin. So my question for 2018 is, what would it take to really scare them? Is the coin Bitcoin?
Is it indeed, Colm O'Regan, posing a key question, which I'm going to throw to my panel in a second. I will introduce them first from the city of Constance in Germany, Guntram Wolf, director of Bruegel, the leading European think tank. From the US, braving US superstorms, cyclone bombs, no less, we have Megan Green, chief economist at Manulife Asset Management, and Ian Bremmer, the renowned political scientist and president of the Eurasia Group. Megan, kick us off, if you will, and kick the copious snow, no doubt, from your shoes. Tell us about the markets. Record numbers we've been seeing, haven't we, in 2017 in London, New York and Hong Kong. A bull run of 8 years duration, it seems, one of the longest we've seen. Can it survive in 2018?
Well, I think this is the biggest risk is to the global economy is that there is some kind of market correction. And I think it's been a long bull run, but it got a lot of wind in its sails when President Trump was elected. So it's not just a Trump trade, but it got some momentum from President Trump. And initially, speaking to investors, a lot behind it was, optimism about actual policies. As it became clear that policies weren't going to come through, though, I think we've seen a lot of FOMO investing. So just fear of missing out. Investors look at what they would have left on the table if they hadn't been in the markets and feel like they have to be in there. And so that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy until all of a sudden it doesn't. And one thing that could really turn that around is if we got an increase or an acceleration in inflation. And I should point out that we will get an acceleration of inflation in the U.S. at least in 2018. And it's not because of any fundamental reasons. It's just a pure statistical year-on-year calculation. So certain things fall out of that calculation. So if inflation goes up, then fixed income looks a lot better. And you might see some investors pouring out of equities into fixed income. And that could cause a correction, even though nothing has fundamentally changed. There's a number of geopolitical risks as well that I'm sure we'll discuss over the course of the show that could also cause some kind of correction. But I do think it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy until all of a sudden it doesn't, and then everybody runs for the door at the same time and has trouble getting out. And I think that's a big risk for this year.
Guntram Wolf, similar concerns, risks, optimism in Europe?
Absolutely. I think asset prices are definitely overvalued, very highly valued, and it's very much related to monetary policy. And monetary policy, as inflation goes gradually up, will gradually be pulling back. And, then
this is quantitative easing. This is the pumping of money into assets.
Absolutely. So in 2018, we will probably see the end of quantitative easing in Europe, and we will see gradually in 2019 a rise in the interest rates. And so this means that asset prices that have essentially relied on zero interest rates and abundant liquidity will correct.
Ian Bremmer, the X factor here, as always, is geopolitics, isn't it?
Well, not as always. Usually the X factor is not geopolitics. I would argue, especially the macro side, is usually pretty stable. You don't have to deal with it. You focus more on political risk and looking at emerging markets and places where domestically a new government could radically change the investment climate. But we have entered a geopolitical recession, one where the old world order led by the Americans and its allies really is fragmenting. It's breaking down. And in 2018, I don't think anyone looking at the geopolitical environment really believes it's going to get fixed. So that's why I think people are unnerved by the potential of all these crises. And your panel is absolutely right that the markets aren't responding to this yet, but that's not really surprising in the sense that it's easy to respond to a new tax bill or a change in your economic forecast or even a Brexit referendum when you know the date and you know the two potential outcomes. It's much harder to respond to an increased likelihood of nuclear Armageddon on the Korean Peninsula when you don't really have a date and it's a relative still tail risk.
The main risk I see is certainly the man in the White House, Donald Trump, is out there publicly saying that he has the larger button. He's out there going to be under heavy attack now with a new book, Fire and Fury, and that has some interesting revelations, I guess. So I think the overall picture is really one where fundamentally the world has lost trust in the United States as the power that has upheld Western values. These Western values are actually very, very important for just about everything, for trade, for confidence in elites, for our way of doing government, our way of running business, and so on and so forth. The big winner in this whole game is, of course, China, President Xi Jinping. And I think most people, if you ask them, do they trust Xi Jinping to actually care about his people or do they trust Donald Trump to care about his people? I think they would probably vote that Xi Jinping is the guy to be trusted because he cares for his people, while Donald Trump doesn't appear to.
Okay, we're going to pick up on some of the trust issues later in the show. But first, let's stick with China. You mentioned it there. It's a second area of consideration for Colm O'Regan, isn't it? From the comfort of your Dublin armchair, Colm, you've been giving this some thought.
Well, my dealings with China have been limited to last March actually being refused a visa to perform comedy there. And I don't blame them for that, actually. But also, more interestingly, my interest in China has been in the form of small packages of doodads, thingamajigs and bits and bobs, other vital household objects that have made their way into the house via AliExpress. A few years ago, I wouldn't have bought so much as a pencil on the internet, even if it was in the next parish. Now we're trading directly with China as if we were Phoenician merchants in the 15th century. Every year there's a fear that somehow China, its collapse is going to pull the plug on the West and it's going to stop buying the world's raw materials or Britain's replica football shirts, or there's going to be a credit bubble or something. And I wonder, is the way we look at China wrong in that it's so now intertwined? It's changed from the factory of the world to the supermarket of the world. Instead of finding made in China on the base of an object, the precise address of the small business who made it is very clearly printed on the outside of the envelope that arrives into our house nearly every day. So we are so intertwined with China now, I wonder, will it just be business as usual?
Ian Bremmer, what do you think?
I think that clearly the economics are intertwined, and that's a reason why we're not going to see a war between the U.S. and China, even though the trade is going to get more dicey. I think it'll be very careful tit for tat.
Not a trade war, a trade skirmish.
Yes, that's right. And especially because irrespective of what Trump does, she's not going to overreact. He's in a strong position, and he wants the world to move incrementally towards him on his terms. But I think technologically we are heading for a fight. The Chinese increasingly are the other tech superpower, particularly in terms of developments in artificial intelligence. And those systems are not intertwined. People that are on Chinese internet are not on Western internet. People using Chinese apps are not generally using Western apps. That really matters. And it's fragmenting a big piece of the global economy. I think that in 2018, that's really important. And it's not just about Trump, right? I mean, the problems we have with the American system are vastly deeper than the new American president. I think the bigger concern is that if you asked yourself which political system was more in need of structural reform, the American system or the Chinese system, you'd have a real argument on your hands now. And it's shocking to say that in the context of 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 30 years ago. But certainly with other countries around the world thinking who they want to cast their lot with and where they think there's going to be a more stable future, increasingly Beijing seems like a hedge many will bet.
Megan, do you think people would seriously want to cast their lot with China? I mean, if we look in the media, we tend to look at China as economic rise, as somehow with grudging awe, if not with outright awe. The trading power, the growth numbers are enormous. But China does have its own economic fault lines already, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does. So I would absolutely agree that trust in institutions in the West has fallen. But I wouldn't say that we would trust China more, particularly as investors. So there are obviously problems with intellectual property rights, general property rights, capital controls there. So it's still, these things still make doing business in China pretty tricky. The Chinese government announced that they would let foreign firms come in and own a majority of Chinese firms in financial services, which was a huge development. This was China rolling out the red carpet for foreign companies. And even so, I think the uptake will be incredibly slow just because there's a big question about, what if you make a profit and want to take it out of the country? It's not clear you'll be able to do that. So doing business and investing in China is still tricky enough that I don't think that, investors or those looking at the economy will want to throw their lot in with China. Certainly not in 2018, at least. Mm. Maybe much further down the line with a lot more reform in China.
Guntram.
Yeah, well, I agree with Megan, actually. I think China has a lot of domestic problems. Intellectual property rights is one of them. I think state-owned enterprises in particular raise a concern. And, in our dealings with China, especially our dealings as a European, the one thing I really worry about is the fact that China really does run a very different economic system, funded through ample government funding, no competition or little competition domestically, and enters our markets and really distorts our markets. And I think the Europeans really need to mount a very robust response to China's investments in Europe, robust in the sense of using our state aid control, using competition policy forcefully, and of course also screening for security concerns of Chinese investment.
And a big debt pile, though, as well, Ian Bremmer. I mean, that's something people have warned about with China for the last 2 or 3 years. Is that something that could pop?
There are clearly big downside risks long term with China that we don't have to worry about with the United States. One is the state of their environment and the quality of life in big cities as they get wealthier. The second is the debt issue and their ability to address it. And the third is if they're in charge of all their technology as opposed to private sector corporations, then when cyber attacks hit, the sanctity of that data doesn't lie on Equifax. It lies on the Chinese leadership, and that's a vulnerability for them. So still, there's absolutely downside out there, and there are lots of reasons why investors in the West would be better served trusting the United States and European markets, Japanese than Chinese markets. The problem is that when you're talking about trusting the U.S., you're talking about betting on private corporations, where when you're talking about China, it is the government. And the Chinese government's ability as a government to write big checks, to set standards, to create international architecture means that other governments around the world, across Asia, sub-Saharan Africa, even Latin America near the United States, increasingly are tossing their lot in politically and economically with Beijing, because there are a few consequences for them if they say no to Trump or say no to the United States. But if they say no to China, it actually is significantly problematic. And I think that's a change in the way we think about the global economy and the world order.
You're listening to In the Balance with me, Ed Butler, and my guests, Ian Bremmer, Guntram Wolf, and Megan Green, exploring trends and risks ahead for the global economy in 2018. Colm O'Regan is also with us in Dublin. Colm, the trust issue's been raised already. A nagging concern for you?
Yeah, I just wonder if what our attitude in the business sphere will be to hard evidence and data in the next few years. I was watching a video of the new choice for a US ambassador to the Netherlands, and it was put to him something controversial that he had said. He denied he had said it. He called it fake news. Then he was shown footage of him saying it, and then he denied that he had called it fake news. So it felt like a new zenith in the rejection of evidence of one's own eyes, a new level of post-truth to deny you said something a minute ago. And the world in 2017 saw such a war on truth and evidence that it felt like impossible to convince anybody of anything using evidence. And I wonder, in 2018, will it be a year when the war on political truth crosses over into the business and economic sphere? Will people stop believing hard economic data because they'll automatically presume it's fake news with an agenda? And what does that mean?
An interesting question, and one I think I should throw to you, Guntram Wolf. I mean, in Europe, we tend to look about this very much in through the prism of the United States, where the term is being thrown around almost on a daily basis, the collapsing trust in conventional institutions. Is Europe really immune from these shifts?
Well, I think that's the very, very big question. So far, we seem to be fairly immune. Of course, our political system is also affected by it. But so far, it hasn't taken majority governments anywhere. So we seem to be a little bit more robust to the threat of xenophobia and nativism than the United States is. Now, the reason why that may be the case is that we do have a much, much better functioning welfare system. Inequality is much less of an issue than in the United States and in the UK also. There is probably still a lot of differences in terms of culture, political culture, and so on. And so overall, I'm actually quite positive on Europe, holding the line on the Western values.
Ian Bremmer.
I certainly think that Western values globally have less import than they did before. We're moving to a lower common denominator. And I think that there are a few reasons for that. Globalization lost a lot of jobs for people in the working and middle classes in the developed world. These are comparatively rich people in the global environment, but still they don't feel good. Technology and automation, the fourth industrial revolution, is only speeding the pace of that up. And so as a consequence, the willingness to be anti-establishment and anti-science and anti-anyone that speaks with authority because these people have been lying to you, they're not making your life better, I think is growing. And we see young people in Europe and the United States saying that they just don't think democracy and democratic elections are as important to them. They're not as much of a priority. And if they don't feel secure and they don't feel like their kids are going to have opportunities, they're not going to focus as much on openness and liberal democracy. The other issue is an identity politics one. And that clearly is not just about economic robustness. It is also about a feeling of otherness, a feeling of loss of community, of loss of homogeneity, and that open borders are leading to people that aren't integrating and people you don't like and trust being a problem for you. It's interesting that one of the only advanced industrial democracies where you don't see this problem is Japan. Almost still a single party democracy. It's close to one. But in Japan, of course, the population is shrinking, so the middle class still doesn't feel threatened. And in Japan, you have no immigration whatsoever. And those two things are radically different.
Megan Green, this affects the language surrounding economic debate, doesn't it? And yet, as perhaps has been touched upon, it doesn't always reflect the truth of economic debate. People feel things differently because of this sense of fake news or different constituencies telling them how to think and feel. But it doesn't necessarily reflect what's really going on economically in people's pockets.
No, so it doesn't necessarily. I mean, I would agree with Ian's classification of populism coming from both economic factors and identity politics. But I think if you look at populist waves we've had throughout history, they tend to sort of coincide with the business cycle, which in the past has lasted roughly every, about 10 years. And I think what we're seeing now is the business cycle as we've always known it just doesn't exist anymore. It's much, much longer. And that's because every time you would normally have a repricing of capital goods and labor, central banks step in to avoid it because it would be so painful for every major economy. And they kind of goose the system. So this has just been an incredibly long business cycle. And it's given populist movements an extra long runway to sort of gain support. And so I worry that Guntram is maybe speaking a bit too soon in terms of there not really being a populist threat in Europe, because, of course, we have the Italian elections coming up on March 4th. And it's possible you'll get a five-star movement and Lega Nord majority government. And those are two populist parties. They've spoken about Italy choosing, having a referendum to leave the euro, for example. And it's not my base case scenario, but the impact would be so high, I think it's worth looking at. In terms of, fake news and the economics of it, I think people aren't feeling as good as our GDP growth figures would suggest, in part because we haven't had a whole lot of wage growth anywhere. I'm not sure that fake news is misrepresenting some of that. It could be actually our economic figures that are misrepresenting how well things are going.
Indeed. And if we refer back to those voices we heard at the beginning of the program from India and Spain and Kenya, people were feeling, under the wrap in terms of employment numbers and rates of pay. Ian, you've talked about geopolitical recession. I'd like to return you to that term and what might reverse that. I mean, isn't it possible when we talk about this fake news that we could have a pushback?
Well, I think one thing that's helping in the United States is the fact that the system is fairly decentralized. So if Washington doesn't get anything done, people still have a lot of respect for their mayors, for their city councils, in many cases for their individual congressional representatives, even if they don't respect Congress as an institution. And it's so interesting that, you see the net neutrality rollback for Trump, and then you see actually that many states around the country are putting their own legislation in place that will limit the changes that occur. The energy revolution in the United States largely happened in spite of Obama. It was at the local levels. Now, the problem with decentralization is there are a lot of places that don't have the benefit of good governance, and it creates more inequality. And I guess the real question about what reverses a geopolitical recession is whether to what extent we can continue to deal with growing structural inequality. I think we can. I don't think it's a crisis. I think it's a chronic condition. It's one that does not imply a quick fix. I think the geopolitical recession is one that, frankly, the United States is not bothered by at the macro level. You have very few migrants coming in. Refugees from Syria can't swim to the United States. Terrorism is a much lower risk in the U.S. than it is in Europe, or certainly in the Middle East or South Asia or North Africa. North Korea, Trump is saying a lot about it. But if there's a real problem with North Korea, the South Koreans and the Chinese, the Japanese are facing the brunt of that, not the Americans. So the one country that could do the most to respond to a geopolitical recession is basically telling you this is not our problem. And that has little to do with Trump. I mean, Trump certainly exacerbated it. But I think if you got rid of Trump tomorrow, this problem would still be with us. And that's what makes me more concerned about the geopolitical recession, because if you're not going to fix it the way you did after the economic recession, everyone's saying, oh, my God, we need to stimulate the economy, we need to do something, then the alternative is we'll start to fall off. And that's when you see crises.
Okay, well, we have covered all sorts of stories today. A quick question for all of you now, though, to wrap this up. Predictions, specific ones, stick your neck out. One thing to watch for in 2018. Megan, agree?
I think some kind of open conflict, either in the Middle East or in Asia, that will shock us and certainly roil the markets.
Okay. Guntram?
Well, the one thing we didn't talk about is Taiwan. Will we see some conflict emerging in Taiwan driven by China? And, well, let me give a positive one. Germany will hopefully win the World Cup.
Yeah, I was going to put that. What if Iran won the World Cup, the US not even having qualified, Ian Bremmer? Would that cause shockwaves?
No. I think we're all going to die. But not this year, later. And so that's a good news. I think that the one prediction I'd probably make is that Mexico is in a lot of trouble this year. López Obrador could easily win that election, and NAFTA is not going to be negotiated or renegotiated easily. They're quite vulnerable. In fact, probably more vulnerable than any other country out there among America's allies.
Okay, I'm going to have to refer finally to a column in his armchair in Dublin. Not a literal armchair, but an armchair we give to him each week. We speak to him. Column, a final thought for 2018, a prediction?
Well, I'm waiting for 2018 to be the year when a high street hotel or something that provides service to business people touts no internet access as an ultimate selling point to enable anyone in there to get some work done or to just get away from it all.
Perfect. Wonderful thought. Colm O'Regan there in Dublin. And that's it for today's In the Balance. My thanks to my other guests, Guntram Wolf, director of the Bruegel Institute in Europe, and from the United States, Megan Green of Manulife Asset Management, and Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group. Thanks to you all for listening. We will be back with more at the same time next week. Do join us then.